Alton here. At MSA, our health and safety drives them to develop advanced safety equipment with performance and protection in perfect balance, like Globe Athletics, the latest innovation in turnout gear. Developed as athletic gear for firefighters, Athletics uses unique stretch fabrics that provide body contoured fit for unprecedented range of motion and flexibility. It's lighter weight, less bulky, and provides the protection you need from your turnout gear. Get the full story at msafire.com/globe.
All right, we have our sponsorship done, and very excited to come back and do the show with everybody. I was off last show out of town, and we did a lot of brainstorming, and thanks to Anthony Rowett, we've been able to get just an amazing. What I'm really excited to hear from is our guest tonight, and we kind of bounced around some different ideas for tonight's show for everybody who's been listening on and off about it, and we really focus on engine stuff, obviously, but tonight's going to be a little bit different. We're going to talk a little bit about some old school fire, some new school fire, and some innovations in the fire service, and our guest is definitely going to bring a whole new perspective. And if you read anything, follow anything, know anything about the Houston Fire Department, this name is going to be real recognizable, and I'll wait till we get around, and I'm going to let him introduce himself to everybody here in just a minute. So let me start off just as a reminder. My name is Todd Edwards, retired from Atlanta Fire Rescue after 30-plus years. Very fortunate, lucky, and blessed to get to work with these guys on the podcast and get to teach with some of these guys at different places and locations throughout the country. And again, just an honor to have an opportunity to talk a little fire and with everybody tonight. So I'm going to go ahead and let the other panelists introduce themselves. We'll start with you, Joe.
Hey, guys. My name is Joe Ficarelli. I'm a lieutenant with the fire department in New York City. I've been there now going on 12 and a half, coming close to 13 years. I've been promoted about three. I work in Midtown Manhattan in 40 Engine. I'm looking forward to hearing some old school fire stories from these guys tonight, since all I know is about 2008 and on. So I'm excited for tonight.
All right. Mr. Rowett.
My name's Anthony Rowett. I'm a captain with the Mobile Fire Rescue Department in Mobile, Alabama. I've been here 12 years, started out as a volunteer in northern New Jersey in Ogdensburg 3 years prior to getting on Mobile. Got to start teaching with these guys, and definitely looking forward for everyone to get to hear from our guest tonight, because he's a good friend of mine, and definitely like to hear his stories and what he's seen change in the fire service over the years that he's been involved.
And our guest tonight, Captain, if you could please introduce yourself and tell us your length of time on the job and just a quick little background about yourself for everybody that's listening and may not be aware who you are.
All right. Clifford Reed. I was captain with Houston for 36 years. Joined a young age right after high school. I was working in a supermarket, and I hated it. It was inside. And one of my neighbors that I lived in apartments with, he said, "Man, I can't wait to go to work tomorrow." I said, "What? What do you do?" He said, "I'm a fireman." I said, "A fireman? I never even considered doing that." And I said, "You want to go to work?" He said, "Yeah." He said, "Come up to the station and visit." You know, so I kind of did that, got interested. But it was I got there. I got joined the fire department. I put in for the police department, the fire department, the light company, and telephone company. And fire was the first one to call. So I went down and applied with them. And they told me I was too fat. they wanted me to weigh. I was 5'8" and a half. I weighed right at 200. He said, "You got to weigh 172. I said, "You got to be kidding me. I got big bones, man." Anyway, I lost a bunch of weight, didn't eat for about 2 weeks, and barely skimmed through. But I got there because of the benefits. I had no idea I was going to love it. I went through fire school, and it was fun, but when I got to the station, and we made, they hit the station. Of course, I don't remember what they said, but we all ran the fire truck and run down the road, but I said, "You're going to pay me to do this? I can't believe it." I mean, just outstanding, and the excitement was just unbelievable, and then we got to the fire, which was another story, but that's me kind of nutshell. I loved it for 36 years, and I retired trying to you know, have a little bit more life. If I'd known I was going to live as long as I was, I'd have stayed about 15 more years. But anyway, that's kind of me. Just I loved it. I still love it. I had a ball. I was in a time where you could really change a lot of stuff, and we did. And lucky they just let me have free rein and kind of go. So they didn't stomp on me. Didn't agree with everything I did, but they let me do it. But that's
Captain, for guys that may not be really familiar about Houston, and I think people underestimate or don't always really truly understand just how damn big that fire department is. Can you just a little bit of background about the Houston Fire Department as it is today?
Well, today I think we've got over 100 stations. We cover about 759 square miles. It's spread out all over the place. We average monthly about, I'm thinking, right at 30,000 runs. It's just a busy, busy place. The engine I was on was averaging 25 runs a day. And, you know, probably 80% was EMS, but we did make our share of fires. So it's a big, busy department. Now, not all of them that way. Everybody's busy with EMS runs, but there's just certain areas that are, you know, busy with your fires. So I think that's true everywhere. You got busy fire districts. Everybody's busy EMS-wise.
Well, that's incredible. And before we get too far deep, I'd be remiss by not mentioning that, you know, for all our listeners and people will be listening to it over the next couple of days and, you know, weeks or whenever guys get a chance to listen to this, that we are fast approaching the anniversary of 9/11. And I just think that it's one of those, it's sad what's going on in our country and the disrespect our law enforcement brothers are suffering. And even a lot of our fire personnel with fire tracks being attacked and everything else, that I truly hope that people take a step back and remember, you know, not so much 9/11, but remember the 12th instead, and how the entire country came together and how we stood up for our firefighters, our 343 brothers lost that day, along with our police officers that were lost as well, trying to do nothing more than rescue others. And we stood behind them. Myself personally, I still stand behind our brothers in law enforcement, and I hope that everybody will just take a minute during the course of these next several days. Obviously Joe will, because he's part of that brotherhood there in New York, but I think all of us need to take that step back and remember that. And I didn't want to start to show off, you know, talking about 9/11 or anything, but I definitely wanted to mention it before we got off our topic.
This year is going to be a little different, because our job has come out and been like, you know, try to keep the memorials down to a minimum and everything, because of, you know, all the craziness going on. And, you know, my firehouse lost 10 guys.
Wow.
11 guys. Responded that day. One came back.
Wow.
So we have our, you know, our big memorial plan, 7:30 in the morning on Friday morning. We're going to be there. But, you know, it's the day of volunteering. Build up your community. Make it better. Don't destroy. Make it nice.
Thank you. I think that's just, you know, again, I wanted us to make sure we recognize that, since we're, you know, doing the show, you know, 5 days before, and make sure that none of us forget that. And I know it's easy to say, you know, gone but not forgotten. Everybody's really good about putting little taglines on Facebook, but I hope everybody will kind of take what Joe just said and what we're saying about the importance of remembering those fallen brothers and sisters on that day. So let me get into this. Obviously, we have Captain Reed, who came on the job probably a little bit before some of the guys listening were born. So that'll be an interesting way to look at the thing. It's definitely a different fire service, Captain. And I think Anthony and Joe agree with me. You know, even as they've been coming up through the ranks, the fire service has changed by leaps and bounds. And I thought a really good way to lead out is, I'm curious, I know kind of what you said, but how were you raised in the fire service, you know, as far as your leadership and the importance of the job and the love of it? I love that you said multiple times how much you loved it. You were amazed you're getting paid to do it.
Right. Right.
But how were you raised in the fire service? You know, as you got into your first, second, third years into the job?
Well, you know, back then we had to buy our own coat. They issued a fiberglass helmet, and we bought our own boots, and they were pull-up boots. You didn't even issue gloves. I mean, you had to buy, if you bought a pair of white mules, you were a really good fireman. They weren't the rubber-coated gloves. So it was a training process. You know, you had your guys that were at your busy stations that made fires, and back then you're talking about five or six runs a day were busy stations. And I had to go, I put in to go where my buddy worked at 33's, which is really a slow area of town. And the chief out there, and I came out pretty good in class, said, "You want to go to a busy place?" I said, "Well, yeah, I'd like to learn." He said, "You need to go to 35. That was in south end of town. Did they make a lot of fire?" So I said, "Well, I don't know anything about that, but I'll go there." So I did. And like I say, when the book went off, I didn't even know they gave locations. I just, it was a blur to get to the back of the fire truck and jump on and wheel on down the road. And it's just amazing with the stuff that you had on, the equipment. Like I said, we bought gloves. We talked to the other guys, the good guys, said, "Yeah, you got to buy these, you got to do this." And if you had a, you know, if you could see one when you run down the road, you pulled up your boots. If you didn't see it, you left your boots down. Like, that's going to do a whole lot. But you had your, you know, your coat, your helmet, that was it. Everything else was wide open. And, you know, they told you had to, you know, if you got to save people, you got to get inside to do it. And that all sounded good until you tried to step inside. And that's where the heat and, you know, bad stuff was. And, you, of course, you back in, you crawled in. There was no standing. It was all crawling. But you crawled in as far as you could. And when you opened the line, you created steam, and you got burned every time you opened the line. You try to get as close as you could to it. Because they always told you, get to the sea of the fire, get to the sea of the fire. And you pushed, even though you couldn't see. You were listening to sounds back then, the crackling and popping. But if you opened your eyes, it just burned your eyes. So you heard the popping and cracking. You opened the line, you shut it off, and you listen to see if it's still cracking and popping. But it was just a different time back then. It just really was kind of like it is now, still barbaric. All the things we do are barbaric. We just got different equipment to be barbaric with, you know. So it was a fun job. It just, I loved it. I loved the excitement. I loved, you know, the fire. I when I was growing up, you saw fires on TV, but TV fires are never hot. You know, the first actually fire I made, it was burning. I couldn't believe the heat it was putting out. We were running up to it and had to run back because it was burning it. You know, I said, wow, it's not like that on TV, you know. So you learn what you could and couldn't do. But the whole deal of the quest was to get inside where the people were to save them. And that became a problem because once you got inside, you couldn't see. You burned yourself. And it just, you're kind of like a, you know, we're failing at this. We're supposed to be in there saving people, and we can't even get inside. Mm-hmm. So we just, I was in about 8 years, I guess, before I figured out there's got to be a better way, you know. So we went on the quest to try to do things different, get inside and do stuff, but not hurt ourselves. You know, that's the biggest thing. And they're saying, right, you know, if you're burning your ears and your face every time you're going in, this couldn't be good. This is not right. But, you know, not everybody was doing that, but some of the more aggressive guys were. So we were just trying to figure out a different way to do things. Except, you know, we didn't want to go to the window because they said if you go to the window, you're just going to push heat and steam on everybody. And it made sense because I've been inside when they stuck a lot in the window and, it, you know, it blow on you. And I know we've had studies that say different, but I've been inside when they stuck the line on the window, and it wasn't easy, you know. Not bad when you got gear on. Most citizens don't wear gear, though, so you got to think about that. But we, right. That's where the, you know, the hood thing came about. Just got tired.
Yeah, and I want to come back, and for the guys listening, and this will be, and I love that the way you started that off, Captain, because Captain Reed actually, being from experience, is the innovator of a hood still utilized in the Houston Fire Department today, and we're going to talk about that. I want to ask, while we're on this topic of how we were raised in the fire service, I want to ask Joe how he was kind of brought up in the fire service, you know, not just the academy, but your real introduction once you got to a fire station, kind of like what Captain Reed. I do want to say, in case somebody missed it, what Captain Reed said, and I want everybody to, you know, I'll do a Kurt Isaac there, write this down. To save people, you had to go inside. And this was in 1968. This is what they were being told. So please write that down, because that rule still holds true. We're going to circle back around to that. Joe, how were you kind of raised up, for your career being a lieutenant now with the business department in the country?
Well, it all started when I was a volunteer when I was 17 years old, and the volunteer chief of my department was a firefighter in Rescue 1. His nickname was the Rhino. So just to give you some sort of idea what this guy looked like. You know, this massive, big dude who's just really into the job. You know, he always used to say, I've been studying for this job since I was born.
Uh-huh.
And he was just into it. You know, you get in there, you do what you need to do. It's just part of the job. There's no such thing as outside firefighting. Outside firefighting, you might as well go to California and be a forest fire. You do what you need to do. It's dirty. It's tough. It's hot. You don't know where the fire is. Take your glove off and stick your hand up in the air. You're going to find out where the fire is real quick.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's things that I grew up hearing into this fire service. Like, if you don't know where something is, open up the line real quick. See if you can, you know, reset the fire, but you're inside and you're trying to see if you can figure out which way the fire is going.
Uh-huh.
And that's what we did. That's what we do now. My department, the culture isn't changed. You know, they're trying to talk about knocking down fires from the outside, but that's impractical when you're 19 stories up.
Right.
You know what? Go into the apartment, you put out the fire, you get your ass kicked. It's okay. Your helmet looks like it's got 20 years after you come out. You enjoy it, and you move on. You have a great story.
Yeah.
You sit around the kitchen table afterwards, and you talk, about it, and you learn, from your mistakes. My company went to a fire last week. We spent 3 days each shift going to that fire building to talk about it. Why? Just so we can learn. Someone made a mistake, but that's okay, because – you know, my job as an officer is to let the young guys know is every fire you make a mistake and you learn about it. Don't shy from it. Say you made the mistake. You own it and then move on and then learn from it. And then not only do you learn from it, but teach other guys not to make the same mistake you made.
There you go.
Yeah.
That's it.
No,
just be honest with yourself. No one's a perfect fireman. If someone thinks they're a perfect fireman, they're lying to you or have never been to a fire. So just do it, go out there, make a mistake, learn from it, and move on.
Yeah, I don't think there's anything, there's no such thing as a perfect fire ground operation every single time, or that you've done everything perfect. And I agree with you. If you think you're the perfect fireman or the perfect company officer, it's time for you to go ahead and hang up your helmet and move on, because you're going to get somebody seriously injured or killed one night.
Yes, sir.
Anthony, how were you raised?
I'm like Captain Reed. I didn't have to buy my own equipment. I didn't have to do that. But starting out as a volunteer in where I volunteered at in North Jersey, they were very, very into training. So I started my senior year of high school, and it was a very training prone environment. And studying other fires and going over fires they made. And then as I got into when I got to go through the fire academy, we made some fires, and they were constantly going back to those, trying to learn from them and all that kind of stuff. And then when I moved down here, got on the fire department here, went through rookie school, and to this day, the guy doesn't like me talking about it because he doesn't like getting attention for anything. But got assigned out of the training center. The first day, we don't necessarily have the senior man role in the way that New York does. With a lot of time, it goes to that driver, and that's who fills that role. They're that more senior person. And the driver assigned to the truck or the engine I went to, he pulled me aside, and it was even just the little stuff. Right after shift change, had a meeting with the officer that I was going to work for. Then the crew pulled me aside, had their little meeting with me, and then he took me outside, and he was like, and to me it was the little thing. He said, I want you to check my vital signs. I was like, okay, why? We went through everything, checked blood pressure, blood sugar, everything. I was like, man, what's the big deal? And he was like, no, the training center, they just teach you the basics. They just have to get you to us. It's our job to teach you from now on. So everywhere you go, you represent us. And you have to do a good job because you represent this company and all the people in it. And then it built from the little things like vital signs all the way through everything we did. And then he always had that attitude that we have to teach you. That's our job. But you represent us, so you should have pride in what you do to make sure you do a good job. And then that's kind of carried my whole career with everyone I've worked with. I've had good captains that were very into training and aggressive people, and they kind of all built. But it all followed that same mentality that you represent that company and the people that are teaching you. And the company always took that mentality. And what he told me when I first came out was the training academy just pulls the rock out of the dirt. We got to polish you into a diamond.
There you go. Okay. I hadn't heard that before. I like that. I definitely like that. And I, much like these guys, very young, I think I made my first fire about, I was around 7 years old, riding with my dad, and we pulled up, and he called a call. He had his little lights and siren in his pickup truck, and we responded. I sat in the truck and watched these guys run. It looked like total chaos to me at 7 years old, but knew right then what I was going to do, and I spent my entire life just, waiting for the opportunity, and started as a volunteer at 16 years old, and started applying everywhere in the country to get on a big city job, and landed in Atlanta and went to the academy with some very old veteran, crusty, in your face, yelling and screaming instructors, and then just was extremely lucky and blessed to go to a very, very busy house. We had four major public housing complexes, and we would make a fire or two every shift there, and that's where we got proven at. We didn't lay out 800 feet of 5-inch and 6 hand lines. We pulled one booster, and the captain expects you to put that thing out with that 500 gallons, and there was no question about it. You were going to put that thing out, or you were being transferred. And so learned a lot, but I had a captain that after every fire, we'd walk in every room. He'd show you parts of the building you didn't know about, how to open things up, how to not do damage, where to do damage, and it was just a great upbringing, to have that senior, older captain to kind of, take his time with us at the same time in our ass when we screwed up. And it was just a great upbringing as a young firefighter in big city departments. So I think all of us, always, every time I ask these stories, I love hearing how guys were brought up and things they were told. And I think that kind of leads, and I'll start back with Captain Reed. And what do you, your last few years on the job, Captain, what were some of the things you saw as far as like the change in the fire service that you thought were positives?
Well,
besides not having to buy your own gear anymore.
Yeah, it really started back, I guess, probably mid-80s when we really started to get into hoods. When we got into hoods, the gear we were wearing was Nomex, what I thought was a magical gear. I didn't think it burned when I made fires and they burn off. And then I started doing studies into gear. Nomex doesn't continue to burn. It burns, it doesn't continue to burn. I was really enlightened on a lot of stuff because we went from Nomex 1 to 2 to 3 to PBI, to some really great stuff. And I was kind of in the middle of all that because I made this hood, and when I made the hood, air pack straps melted off, gear melted off, and they were accusing me of being nuts. And I was on the side of, we're firefighters. This stuff shouldn't happen. It should not happen this way. We're supposed to go in and get people out, and we don't even have gear to do it with. So that was my take on it. It wasn't crazy. I wanted better stuff. And so we started with that, with the gear stuff, which meant better gear, better gloves, bunker pants, and most guys wore bunker pants at night. And I was thinking, are fires hotter at night or what? What's the deal with that? But, finally, guys were wearing them, and then they wanted to pull the liners out because they're too hot. And I'm thinking, guys, you're wearing this for a reason. You got a liner in your coat for a reason, And there, you know, any even NFPA back then was saying you need to be an ensemble of total protection, which when you finally had a good hood, you were, but they were scared to death of the death hood, the reed hood, because it said you got in there too far. I said, well, what is too far? What's that magical thing that's too far? What does that mean? Well, you know, when you get in there too far, I said, no, explain it to me, because, you know, I said, a man needs to know his limitations. When are you hot? Mm-hmm. When are you too hot? You know, all that kind of stuff. When you need to know that, you need to learn that so you can don't overextend yourself. But you can't just put, oh, in too far. That's just a falsehood that guys like to, you know, throw out there. But my guys were trained. I trained them. We'd go out to the academy. I'd make them stand in front of the fire till they couldn't stand it anymore. And I'd back them up. I'd say, you guys okay? And I thought I was burnt up, but I'm a little red, but I'm okay. I said, well, okay, so now you can go a little bit more, right? Yeah, but I just didn't know I could do that. You know, your body kind of lies to you. You know, let's go, just like you're in a bad one. And you always want to leave because it's too hot. But if you stay a little bit longer, make the extra 2 or 3 feet, that push, you put it out, and then you're okay. But you learn each time. You learn you can take a little bit more. Of course, there's times you get burned. I don't mind taking a few blisters if I can save somebody. Now, just to burn for fun, no, I don't like that. You know, that's not mm-hmm. fun. But, you know, to save somebody, sure, I'll push it a little bit more. You know, if I see you on the other side of the room and I know I can get to it and it's well involved with the stuff I had on, I could go over there and pull you out if you're alive.
What?
you got to realize with, that, too.
With what you're saying there, Captain, what are your feelings? And I think one of the big subject matters throughout the country, and depending on who you're talking to and what article you're reading this week about survivability profiling, and that kind of leads me to the topic of a fire you were involved in where you guys had reported a lot of people trapped, and you guys really had to make a hard push to make that grab. What do you think about survivability profiling?
Well, I think it's a good saying. I don't believe in it because I've been so many fires that if we didn't make the push, the person would have died. You know, it's just with the proper gear on and you're being properly trained and ventilation and all that stuff, you should have a reasonable chance to make, you know, pull somebody out, make that grab. Where that came from, that fire he's talking about, we're in the station, and they hit us, and we pulled out in front of the station. It was about probably 6 or 7 blocks from us. You could see the column of smoke, so we knew we got one, and you know, everybody's excited. And then they come back on the radio, and they give you that message nobody wants to hear. People trapped. Well, then it's not fun anymore. It's business. It's all business. You have all your stuff on right, no second chances, nothing. Just get everything right. We pulled in front of this house, and when I jumped off the fire truck, a lady grabbed me and was screaming. And I was looking at the fire. The house was well involved. I saw fire at every window. And she said, my babies are in there, my babies. And I said, y'all here, but I'm trying to, what am I going to do here? And I said, how many? She said, 9. And I thought to myself, they're all dead, you know. And I said, you sure? She said, yes, they're all there. So I kind of looked to the left, and there's one window on the back side, left side, that heavy black smoke was pushing out, but no fire. I said, let's go this way. So I ran down there, just half up on cinder blocks. The window came, the bottom of the window was about the middle, the middle of my chest. And I was looking in, my light shined about maybe 3 or 4 inches, you know, wouldn't go much. And I yelled out. Of course, you got a mask on, too, so you're yelling out. And the neighbors there picked me up and threw me in. They'd seen fire, so they figured I wanted to go in, so they helped me. They threw me in. And I hit the floor with a crash, and it was kind of hot already, and I was feeling around. It was a relatively small room, about maybe 10 by 10, 10 by 12, with a bunch of junk everywhere, and I was feeling around. I couldn't see anything, couldn't feel anything. Well, I got close to the door, and I could see fire starting to come in the room. I went back to the window, and I hollered at my first lineman, Hulk. I said, hey, get the line. They had the line. I said, bring the line in. We've got a bunch of kids in here. Let's go in and try to find them. So he pulled the line in, and I grabbed it and went to the door and was kind of standing in the hallway, just doing short bursts, trying to not create steam but hold the fire back. I said, hey, just search his room. Supposed to be a bunch of kids. Okay, Captain. So he searched, and he's, searching, and I swear he was going an hour because it was hot. And he come back. He said, Captain, I can't find him, buddy. I can't find him. I said, Hog, can you go some more? He said, yeah, I'll go. And I said, it's supposed to be 9 kids in here, Hog, so, or at least in that room, they'd be alive. The rest of them would have been dead because it was well involved. And I said, go back. So he come back after another hour that he'd been gone, and he said, I found one. I threw him out the window. They didn't actually mean throw him out. He passed him out. And he come back. I said, hey, can you go again? He said, yeah, I'm tired. I said, yeah, we're both tired, buddy. Let's go one more push. So he went again, and he came back, and his vibrator alert was going off. He said, Captain, I can't find him. I said, all right. I said, let's try to make let's get enough slack in here. Let's push to the front of the house, try to put out as much fire as we can, get some more guys in here. They can do a search. We're done. Okay, sounds good. So we pushed the hallway and probably all 15 or 20 feet into the living room. And we ran out of slack. I put as much as I could out. I said, you see the door? He said, yeah. I said, well, let's go. I said, get up and run. And we did one last burst, and we ran through the doorway. Well, I didn't see the bottom part of the screen was still there, the bottom door, which was about a foot and a half high. I was looking at the big, and we ran that way, and of course, we tripped on it and fell out on the porch. We were out, which I was tickled to death. And he fell on top of me, and they pushed off the porch, And my thoughts immediately went to the other kids. We pulled one out. And the chief ran up, you okay? I said, yeah, I'm okay. He said, well, you need to go to the hospital. You're over 50. They think you had a heart attack every time you go down. I said, no. I'm good. I said, what about the kids? He said, well, the one y'all brought out is right there. He was sitting up in the back of the ambulance crying. And I thought, wow. I said, what about the rest? He said, they all made it out. And the little kids were crying because they left their brother in there, because they got hot. And this little kid was 3 years old. He was between the headboard and the mattress. And the way the bed was positioned, the grass was going around him out the window. And he was fine. Wasn't even blistered. And wow. It was just amazing to me. But going back to look at this, I thought, when I looked at that, when I first saw it, I said, there's nobody alive in here. No way. And that showed me good because we rescued the guy. It was extreme condition, but we rescued the kid. He was okay, wasn't even burnt. And we saved the guy. And it just showed me right then. I'd been in, 15 years or so and made a lot of fires. And they talked about this stuff. If it's that bad, don't go in. Don't take a chance. risk a little, save a little, risk a lot, save a lot. But, guys talk, but it's just when it's your position, and of course you want to do good, but most of all you want to save somebody if they got a chance. I always told my guys, treat this like it's your family. If it's your family in there, what would you do? Well, you got to go and get them. I said, exactly. And I don't want you guys hurt above anything. No fire is worth a fireman's life, but I want you to do the best you can. Because you can do a lot more than you think. You just got to push it. So that's kind of where we came back. We went back and talked about this fire, for a long time. And many more that we made that we gave good efforts on. And there was ones we did good effort and didn't make the grab. We couldn't find him. But there was more than one crew at every fire. And you can't do everything. Fire ground's a comedy of errors. And whoever corrects the mistakes the quickest wins. Because we all make mistakes. But we all correct them, or hopefully you correct them. That's kind of my take on stuff. You dress the best, you prepare for the war to win the battle. Nobody thinks fire is going to flash on. Nobody thinks we're caught in a flashover or back drive, but it happens all the time. But I knew with the stuff I had on, it would take a whole lot more to get me than would the average guy because of the gear I put on. It wasn't that I was trying to be a bad guy. I'll show you how tough I was, but I wanted to protect myself because I knew I was going to be in that position where I'm inside and you don't know what's going to happen. And back in those days, they really didn't ventilate a whole lot. They said they were, but they weren't real polished on that ventilation thing. So you kind of, stuck it out. The first hole I had cut, I've been in I guess 15 years, 16 years, push in, you know, down low where the phone jack and stuff were, that was all melted. And we made it, got into the kitchen, put it out, and all of a sudden everything lifted up. I thought I did something tricky with a nozzle. I said, man, you see that? I thought maybe we'd been left with a nozzle, you know. And we had a new chief, and I walked out. He said, hey, Captain, that hole help you? And I thought, wow, that's what that was? I couldn't believe it. I said, can you do that? He said, I'll do it every time. I said, man, he made a believer out of me. And after that, I mean, just one time, you know. You guys say vertical ventilation doesn't work. I'm thinking, you've never been in one that has been ventilated, or you wouldn't say that.
Yeah, and I couldn't agree with you more than that. And I know there's departments that, you know, and obviously staffing is going to play a role in that. When you don't have enough staffing to be able to commit guys to a roof, as well as a search, as well as fire attack. But, you know, I still am a believer that, you know, there is a time and a place for everything we do on this job. And right. That includes sometimes a quick knock from the outside. That includes cutting a big ventilation hole. That, and I just think that, you know, sometimes we become we read one blurb of an article and go, oh God, we can't do that anymore. We should be doing this every single time. Right. And it's one of the changes in the fire service that concerns me the most is that we have all these incredible Facebook instructors and Instagram instructors without anything really backing them up. I recommend the young guys to read the UL studies, talk to those guys. But read the whole thing, not one paragraph.
Right. What do most people die from? Smoke inhalation.
Smoke inhalation.
If you get there first, you know, and it's smoke inhalation is killing them, and it's the smoke's down to the floor, you have zero visibility. How long would it take you to search a house? Forever.
Mm-hmm.
If you go up on the roof and cut a hole, at least you get the smoke off of them. You may not find them, but at least you got the smoke off of them with it breathing good air. You know, so it's as if you're first in. What are you going to do? You're going to pull a line or you're going to cut a hole? My kids in there, I'm probably going to go cut a hole.
Anyone with 10 years or less on the job needs to listen to this guy. This is unbelievable stuff that we're hearing right now. I'm loving this right now. I'm just sitting back in awe listening to this, and I'm having so much fun. You two old-timers. Keep talking. I'm loving this. This is like a gospel. I'm loving this.
Well, as you're speaking, you know, it's funny how as much as change, some things don't change. And I love some of the things you said about making that hard push. And I know Joe and I know Anthony have had those fires where you've got to push beyond what you think you can take sometimes and to make that grab. And I couldn't agree with, you know, the comment you made, what would you do if it was your kids? Well, I'd make that push. And all four of us on this panel tonight would make that damn push if it was our kids in there.
Right. Well, that one push you make and that grab you make makes it all worth it. You know, and like, I used to keep count on, you know, fire deaths and stuff. I quit counting at 50 on a dead one. And that was early in my career because just it wasn't fun anymore. It was hard because we're there to save people, and majority of them were not saving. Not because we weren't trying. It just, you know, back then it just fire departments weren't very efficient. You know, they thought they were, but they weren't. You know, the more aggressive we got and the better we got, I can say, man, when I first got in, we thought we were fighting fire. Yeah, just like the air packs. When air packs came, you know, the rookies had to wear them. That was me because the old guy didn't need them. Well, you know, it just, you know, nobody needs one if you can breathe. But when it's bad in there and it's really bad, you ain't breathing without air pack. And so it just, it's a process of elimination. You're going to breathe. I remember the first fire we made and we, you know, put the air packs on and we made one of those fires that just old brick and just smoke pushing out everywhere. And you had your door crew that's sitting in the door. They weren't going to do anything, but they wouldn't let you by. You know, you're sitting right there. You had your circlers, the ones that go around and around, never do anything, just kind of circle. And then we come up behind them, and say, hey, let us through. And they, I mean, they'd elbow you, know, get back, get back. It was our line. Nobody wants to be in the line. And we finally broke our way through and then started pulling a slack. We went probably 30 feet or so. And what bothered me about the air pack is the old guy said, you know, if you wear that, you're going to get in there and you're going to die. And I'm thinking, what's the deal? Well, you're going to get in there so far, you're going to be able to breathe, and you run out of air, you're going to die. That wasn't very confident building, you know, but we got back in there about 30 more feet and put out the fire and have just a bedroom. And then we come back to get out, and they wouldn't let us out. And I said, the fire's out. No, it's not. You see all the smoke? And, you know, had to fight all the way back out. You got out. Me and Danny come out. What I liked was when you took a breath, it was cool air. Instead of having to breathe that nasty smoke, we got out by the pumper, took our stuff off. And the chief was over there patting all these guys on the back. Y'all did a good job. And I took Danny. I said, Danny, those guys did a good job. They were all throwing up in the front yard. You know, me and Danny were breathing good air, no snot hanging out our nose. You know, it was great. So we got to practice with those things. We could be really good with them. But it was just amazing that air pack made so much difference. The problem was the air pack let you go in, then you burned your face, burned your ears off. You know, so it was just another step and a stop. So you get this accomplished, and you create more problems. So. It was fun,
and
it just go ahead.
I was going to say, I mean, I kind of want to bring Joe and Anthony in here for a second, and you know, hearing some of the things that Captain Reed's talking about, and you know, I keep picking up these things that I know I've heard both Joe and Anthony say, and this is coming from a seasoned fire-tested veteran, and these are some of the same messages that we're still literally begging people to listen to and understand.
How sad is that?
It's sad, but also a little encouraging to me in a way that what they were doing early on in his career worked. What we do today can work if we allow it to work, and if we can get everybody thinking that way.
For some reason, back in the like 80s and 90s, you know, some firemen got this in their head to be, you know, very safety conscious. And unfortunately, they're the chiefs that are in charge now that are creating very safety conscious firemen first attitudes, which I think, yes, firemen are important. But when we're on the scene, the civilians are number one. And what I love, you know, what got me into starting to write and starting to teach and then, you know, the snowballing, and I'm sure Anthony can say the same thing, is that we started seeing all these messages coming out, you know, you don't want to cut a hole in the roof right away, you know, all the profiling and whatever the hell they call it. And you know, guys that know what they're talking about are like, wait, no, you want to do these things, you know. Guys have been doing this for 100 years for a reason, not because they're antiquated and they don't want to change, but because for 100 years, this thing has worked. So let's not change the wheel. It still works. Let's do it. So now you're starting to see that change. And I'm so encouraged by it. Hearing these old timers being like, see, this stuff worked, you know, 40 years ago. And there's a reason, because it works. So let's use it now.
Yeah.
Well, that's very true.
Go ahead, Cam.
I just say it's very true, but, you know, to be efficient at ventilation, you have to come off that truck to cut a hole, not to run up there and look and go back and get all your stuff. You got to be ready to go. You know, and that's the biggest difference. If you're brought in that mentality, let's do it when we get there, it's more efficient. A lot of guys, well, it's dangerous on the roof. Well, yeah, it's dangerous on the roof. It's dangerous inside, too. But you make it better. A good truck guy loves making it better for the engine guys. You know, but it's just, I'm all for safety. I really am. But it's become a thorn in our side. Be safe. Be safe. Well, who's going to, you know, if it's your kids, you're going to be safe. You're going to go in and get them. Well, I'm going to go in and get them. Well, you owe that to the citizens, too. You know, you owe that to that person's trapped. You have to be a little bit dangerous. And I don't mean that in a bad way, dangerous, but you have to be able to commit to do that job. Well, you have to. Nobody else is going to do it. You can't call the cops and say, hey, buddy, what do y'all think? you're a professional there. You got to make that decision. Go do it.
Yeah. I think it's like everything in our job. There's a time and a place to immediately get on that roof. There's a time and a place to hold the door. There's a time and a place to, you know, go with a bigger line versus a hand line. And I fall back to this. Some of the things that Captain Reed said, I know we keep referring to as, you know, these old things, but what's really cool when you look at the UL, I mean, really read the studies and ask questions of the guys who are out there riding them. They're just proving a lot of the things that Captain Reed is now saying that they were discovering as they were learning the job under really adverse conditions with rubber boots and no BAs and all those things. Let me, Anthony, are you, what are your kind of your thoughts? I know you've been listening here for a little bit. I kind of wanted to kind of see what you were thinking about the way you were brought up and the changes you've seen and the survivability profile. And that's what they call that, Joe. That is really just to me, it's kind of like, Captain Reed referred to them as circlers. As you're circling the building, doing a profile, that kid's in there eating that smoke and dying.
Right. Yeah. I've been really lucky in where I've worked. I've always worked in the downtown area, which is for the most part a very, very senior district in the city. So I've worked with a lot of senior guys and really good senior guys that teach you, and they have a lot of experience they fall back on. And so when a lot of things started coming out and articles came out that might kind of challenge things, they weren't quick to jump on and make a big change about the way they were doing things. So in the area I work, when the things came out about like survivability profiling or, you know, knock it down through a window before you go in, it didn't fly. It didn't catch on. Those guys weren't going to go for it. They said that, okay, you could write it down. There needed to be more because their experience told them something else. And they went off their experience. Mm-hmm. And that's the people I learned from. I specifically remember one captain, he's over 30 years now, but when the Chiefs came out, they sent out when the first UL study first came out, they made the little videos and they sent out the video. They came around to all the stations, said, hey, we want you to watch these. And right out the gate, I'm like, well, that's not the whole study, you know, so I'm kind of already seeing there's probably going to be an issue here. And I remember this captain was like, well, Chief, I'll watch it, but that's not going to work for me. He said, I know what I've done for 30 years. And his specific statement was,
amen.
When I came on, the captain I had when I came on, if I had tried to put water in a window, he would have hit me in the back of the head with an axe. And
yeah.
So they weren't easy to just throw away all of their experience to jump on a bandwagon until it was proven. And
right.
Now all the rest of the studies come out, and it's proving what all the older, more senior guys' experience was telling them. So I was lucky in that the area of the city I work in and the people I get to work with and around and learn from, they weren't quick to just make a broad change like that. They went based on their experience and what their experience told them. So, to me, I saw the change, but I didn't necessarily have to experience some of the rash change some people did, that they just jumped on something, made a rash change, and then had to go back. I didn't really experience that because the area of the city I work in just didn't really go for it. They kind of kept doing their own thing. They were willing to look into it, but these guys didn't change what they were doing. But they knew what they've been doing for 30 years was working, and they kept teaching their guys, you know, their way. And no one ever, these aren't captains that were telling their guys, you can't go out and read the study or don't go out and learn anything, but they were telling them, this is what I know for a fact works. I've done this for 30 years in this area. I mean, these are guys that worked in the same companies, you know, their whole career. So one guy I look up to a lot, I relieve him in the morning now, so that's a pretty good thing for me, is when I came on the fire department, he was a captain on the engine I work on now on the A shift, and I worked on the B shift, and I've got to work in that same company my whole career, basically in all three ranks and all that. But now I'm his relief, and he's very about the way he learned, and it's because it's his experience worked. He's worked in two fire stations in his entire career. He just got 30 years on. He worked in engine 8 when he first came on, and as a firefighter and as a driver, and that's Engine 8 is second due to our run area, and we're second due to theirs. When he made captain, he came to Engine 3. So he's worked that area for 30 years, and it just wasn't going to change just because someone came out and said you should. He was relying on his experience. And he's got – if you look at our fire department, there's some guys that everyone will tell you, these are some of the best guys we've got, and they're some of the most experienced. And there's a handful of guys that if you go around our fire department and ask, it's going to be the same names every time. And I get, you know, they just didn't change just for the, you know, pure reason to change.
So
we didn't
necessarily
live through the change. I saw it. I didn't necessarily experience it.
No, I know exactly what you're talking about. When I first got on the job, I got on in 08. I was assigned to a trunk company. Don't hate me. I was a truckie. Written in our books for the roof man, number one thing, nothing shall deter the roof man from getting to the roof. And when he gets up there, what's the first thing you do? You pop that bulkhead. You create that vertical vent. And that's words they lived by for 100 years. And then 2011, 2012, the job came out. It was like, you know what? The roof man needs to ask permission before he vents. He needs to wait for the line to be in place. So you don't want to create that flow path. And all these veteran guys looked at the job and was like, what are you talking about? We know what we're doing. We've done this for so long. And 2 years ago, the job backtracked on that because they realized that, you know what? This policy, yeah, we get it. There might be that one in a million chance that pulling that bulkhead right away can create that flow path and cause a bad fire. But the rest of the time, it's going to be beneficial. The 999,000 times, it's going to work great, and it's what the guys need. And there's nothing like it. That first time you're in a fire, and it's completely banked down, you can't see nothing, and all of a sudden, it just lifts. It's like magic. It's the coolest thing in the world. And you know, recently, it seems like a lot of departments are trying to regress backwards and try to change things in the name of safety. And in the name of this is the new way to do it, and it's just not working. And the old ways, hearing these old timers talk, hearing Captain Reed and all these guys, the wealth of knowledge they have, and you're like, I it works. The things that they're talking about that they did 40, 50 years ago in the 50s and 60s is what we should be doing now. More so now because the fires are crazier now than they were back then, and we're getting less of them. So we're less trained, we're less experienced. We need to listen to these guys.
Yeah, and I'll just kind of echo all three of y'all's responses that, you know, the information's out there. And I think we need to take a look at what our senior members have experienced, what the studies are showing us, our fuel loads, our packages, the structural designs. And it's vital in today's job that everybody stays up to date. I know it seems like a daunting task because we're inundated sometimes with so much information, but we still have firefighters and fire departments in this country that don't even know how much water they're flowing out of their lines.
Exactly.
You know, that information is so easily available to find out, you know, how many GPMs are you getting out of that 1 3/4 with a solid bore tip, with a 7-day tip. That information is everywhere. If people just take a step back and do their own research, try some things, try the old things, try the new things, combine the things together. And I think I'm a firm believer, like all three of you, our safety comes first when we're having these kind of conversations. When we're doing drills at the training center or in our spire houses, that's when it's about us. But when we pull up and a lady's in the front yard telling you her 9 kids are still in the house, it's kind of about them at that point. It's not about us at that point. If we've learned our jobs and we're, you know, competent at what the hell we're doing, we're going to be safe. So it drives me insane when somebody pulls that safety card bullshit out versus what were you doing the last 3 months of your career? Sitting on your ass watching YouTube, or were you out training and drilling and getting better at our craft? And if you're not doing that, then you're going to be unsafe. I don't care what fire you're at.
We have training. We're going to be safe. The civilians don't have training, don't have gear, don't have air, don't have protection. We need to get in there and give them that stuff.
The thing that bothers me both right now, when I see YouTube videos or any of these videos of fire, guys get to the scene. Now, this thing is burning. You can see it burning. They get there. They're not dressed. And then they walk around. There's nobody putting water on the fire, nothing. I mean, just, it drives me insane. And I don't understand their thought process. You know,
Or the opposite. They
tank
show
water
up to the...
is quick.
Well, sometimes you see the opposite, too. They show up to the scene, and they're running around with, like they're chickens without a head, not knowing what to do. And that's just as bad as when they show up and they're just walking around in a daze. It's the same sort of process. Just because you're moving faster and you're running around doesn't mean you're actually effective.
Exactly right.
Olms can run around in circles. The circlers. I want to use that circler. I absolutely love that. I've never heard that said before. I've heard a lot of things.
Yeah. I think Tom wrote down circlers is going to start using it. I definitely think you wrote
it down. I did. I'm not going to lie to you. I wrote it down, and it will be in a PowerPoint slide before the end of the night. I don't want to go too far off the topic here, but what do you guys think? And I want to start with Anthony with this question, and I want everybody to, you know, get some input here. What can we do to keep the fire service progressive and keep some of our traditions? I miss some of the traditions I grew up with, in the fire service, you know, and I'm not talking about going back to, you know, strapping guys down to backboards and torturing them, you know, like we used to with rookies, but I don't want to see us go so far away from some of the true traditions of the American fire service that makes us great. And, you know, as much as, you know, I don't even say bashing, but man, for every, you know, one department that's really kind of shaky, there's 100 departments making grabs on a daily basis and are top-notch. They're not always the Chicagos and the Bostons and the LAs and FDNYs. There is Middle America, two-station fire departments that are arriving on scene and making incredible grabs. And you can look at those on YouTube and go, yeah, those guys are trained. This one, their first time going into into this mode. And, I think that's the true credit. But how can all of us, or how can everybody listening, really keep the traditions that are so sacred to the American Fire Service? How can we keep those things alive? What do you think? I'll start with Anthony there.
Well, I think ultimately it's going to fall on the senior guys and that middle range guys, the 10 years and up and all that, and to make sure that the new guys understand the traditions first, because they can't keep them alive without learning them or learning the importance of them. So you definitely have to have that importance on it. And everyone needs to, in my opinion, make it known and understood as people are coming in, the role that those senior guys are playing, that just because you've made it through training, you haven't made it yet. These guys have something you can never get in the training center, and you can never study and learn, because you can't get experience any other way than to do it. So you need to, it needs to be really made aware to new guys as they come in that these guys have something to offer you. You need to take advantage of it and learn it. You can't just get it. You have to learn it from them until you can make those fires and get that experience. So I think it starts with that, and, you know, emphasizing the importance of the senior guys, the senior man position, all that kind of stuff. And I think it also, again, falls on the senior guys and the middle guys to take those young guys and say, yes, there's all this information out there, and we have a wealth of knowledge and information available to us now because of the internet and social media and all that. And you have to help them vet that information and understand that some of it just might not be good. And some of it may be really good, but they're only getting part of it. So they're not really understanding the whole concept or the whole thing they're trying to get, and help them get through all of that process. It's not hard to sit down with a new guy who's energetic and wants to learn and do things on his off days, who, you know, is, if he's energetic and he's trying to learn, he's going to be on Facebook on his off days. He's going to be reading things on his off days. Guide him in the right direction so he's not reading stuff that is just absolutely crazy and detrimental to what the fire service is built on. and help guide them that way. It doesn't take you long to give them some resource and say, hey, man, go here. You'll be able to read some articles here or look up these people. These are really good resources. And read their stuff. All of it's vetted. All of it's good. You can learn from these guys. Doesn't take very long to do that. And someone who's energetic wanting to learn when they first get on, they're going to take that down. They're going to write it down. They're going to go do it. So you can get them learning from those vetted sources that way. And then I also think it's a big part is just the training. I mean, you're going to have to train these guys to understand that there's things they don't know. And that just because they made it through Firefighter 1 and 2, there's still a lot to learn. And when you get hands-on, to me, is when most firemen really learn. And that's not just that they learn the skill, but they also start realizing what they don't know, that this guy has a way to do this. I'm working myself to death, and he's not even, you know, he's 20 years older than me, but he's not even breathing hard doing it. I'm over here dying. Let me learn from him or how to do this search. Or they start telling you in this building, look, this is where the stairs are going to be here. The bedrooms are going to be here. Look at this. As simple as we were at a building the other day, and we walked around it. Bill, I know the building. I've worked in this area a long time. It's got two open elevator shafts in it that aren't really blocked off very well, so it's an easy fall down elevator shaft. But you can also throw a ladder to the windows in the rear and go right into the elevator shaft as well. So we started talking, hey, what does that yellow marking underneath the window mean? And the new guys didn't really know. They knew it meant, you know, they meant something, but it's just an easy thing to say, hey, that's what this means, and go through and do things like that. And I think that starts bringing the traditions and the experience to light for the new guys, just as you start, to an extent, showing them what they don't know compared to those senior guys. But at the end of the day, the tradition can't stay alive without the emphasis being put on the senior guys that have lived them, that know them. Because the new guys don't know it. You can't just expect them to do it. They have to be taught it. So it's going to fall on that middle level and senior guys to keep those things going, and then help those guys. You know, the younger generation that I'm a part of, social media is there. The internet's there. We're used to it. We're used to instant gratification, instant information. People are going to go out there and seek it. So help them along the way so they can be progressive in learning the studies, but not just watch the short clip video that you're only getting a snippet of it and be told to understand the information that's in the entire couple hundred pages that are worth reading.
Mm-hmm. Very good.
No, I totally agree with Anthony. There's nothing like going into a kitchen and seeing a junior guy watching, you know, some fire videos from some random town on YouTube. And the question I ask them is, what are they doing that would work for our department?
Because
every video, right or wrong, you know, whatever you think it is with that video, what are they doing that might work for us? What are they seeing? Why did they make that decision? If you were in that situation in our department, what decision would you make? And make it a learning experience. All the best drills I've ever had in my entire career have been at the kitchen table. The ones I remember the most are the old timers telling me some sort of story going with something that we've been talking about that just randomly came up. The drills that are planned for months and that are big and elaborate, those are whatever. The impromptu talks in the kitchen are what makes a fireman a fireman. And that's what junior men need. Junior firefighters need to hear from the senior firefighters. Even if it's a five-year guy talking to a two-year guy, that five-year guy might have one or two stories that can help that two-year guy just move up in his career, in his knowledge, in his learning. And that's how we advance the fire services, just guys talking to each other at the kitchen.
Very, yeah, I love that. Captain, what do you think?
Exactly. I'm on board with you guys. You know, back in the day, of course, we didn't have YouTube and all the phones and all that, but we sat at the table and talked after every fire. Before every fire, I mean, and that's where all our knowledge came from. You know, what did we do? What could we do better? What didn't you like? You know, just every time we made a fire. And back then, we were making quite a few fires, and they didn't all go perfect. You know, what can we do to make them better? But turning on the basic stuff, you know, can you get dressed properly? Do you have all your stuff on properly? You know, if you can't get dressed, what are you going to do with step two? You know, you got to be able to put all your stuff on. You got to know how much air is in your bottle. You know, how long is that going to last you? You know, how much water, what bottle, what am I going to pull? What's it going to flow? You know, what are you going to do? Back in the day, we pulled an inch and a half, and they thought they were, you know, we pumped 100 engine pressure. That's flowing about 50, 60 gallons a minute. No wonder it didn't work. You know, we started doing studies on engine pressures, and I found out by mistake we made a fire. You pumped 125 on a 150-foot line, which was extreme back then. And we made a fire, and my chauffeur, we pulled up. We had three houses on fire. We pulled two. I said, Chuck, we pulled two lines. He said, okay. So we pulled two, and I got the front yard open. The line, it pushed me back about 5 feet. I shut it off, pulled it back up there, opened it, pushed me back. I liked what it was doing, but, man, we were fighting it, you know, so fire went out pretty quick, and I went back to Chuck. I said, hey, Bubba, you did good on getting water. I said, what were you pumping? He said, well, Kevin, you said 125 on one, you pulled two, so I gave you 250, thinking, but it worked. But we actually started doing studies into how much engine pressure we have to pump on 150-foot lanes, and the hose we have is kind of crappy. We were actually pumping 180 engine pressure to flow 100 gallons a minute. Uh-huh. And it actually worked back then, but it just was a lot of pressure. You had to be ready to open it.
Right. Well, and I think all three of you, just incredible points. And I, one of the things that, I believe in this wholeheartedly, and I try to, promote it, when you guys come onto the job, no matter where that is, get with one of the senior guys, get a book, find out the history of your fire department, find out the history and read about the history of the American Fire Service. There's some incredible books out there. One of the very, one of my first fire books I ever read was a report from Engine Company 82. And I was fascinated by it. I just read these stories it was full buff mode. I'm going to lie. I mean, I was full on buffing and, thinking I was going to be doing all these things. But I learned about the history of the American Fire Service, and I still find it, one of those interesting topics that, maybe it should be mandatory recruit training that you learn about where the fire service started, where it went, where it's going, and how you're now a part of this. And it's not just a part of that one firehouse. It's a part of an entire, culture that spreads across the entire United States of what, the documentary on the San Francisco building their own ladders, it's an amazing thing. And we kind of briefly touched about 9/11. Well, 9/11 is in our kids' history books now. But
right.
How many, if you walk up to the average firefighter outside of FDNY and ask a guy from, whatever fire department, how many brothers were killed on 9/11, the majority of them will not know that answer. They will not be able to suspect. They'll say 200, 300. They won't know the exact number. And when I say history, if we're going to be good and we're going to and get better, I think our history, is definitely part of that educational process to be great at this job, and knowing where we came from and where we're headed to is one of the things
Can I interject for a second?
Yeah, please.
Yeah, just for the 9/11 thing. 9/11 is still happening. There are 199 names on the memorial wall in MetroTech, our fire department headquarters, of guys who have died from post 9/11. This week, they're adding another 29 names. 9/11 is still happening, and soon more guys will have died from 9/11 cancer than died on 9/11 themselves.
Wow.
Yeah, and that's, again, I apologize for not even mentioning that when we opened up the show, and I think that's another one of those. That's our history, that's history that's being made as we're sitting here talking tonight, that we're losing brothers that sacrificed working that pile for days and weeks and months trying to recover, what was left of their fallen, firefighters that were still inside that building, along with all the, I can't even imagine what relief those guys brought to the families of people, even if it was a small remain, just to identify their loved one during that tragedy. But this again goes back to my point, a 21-year-old kid coming into the fire service today needs a lesson, needs a history lesson about the American fire service, and 9/11 should definitely be part of that history lesson. And and that story is going to never be fully, you know, we'll be reading and talking about this story for all of our lifetimes. And I think our young guys need to know the history of that entire event, including the first bombing that occurred there.
Right.
And, you know, and how that changed. That actually helped change some of the things we did in the American Fire Service. So, yeah, the history itself, the service can definitely keep some of our traditions alive. Before I forget, and I just absolutely love where we've been going. For the guys who don't know, and you know, I know everybody's been listening now for a little bit from Captain Reed. He made that statement about to save people, you had to go inside, and they couldn't get inside all time because of the turnout gear. Well, this inspired our guest tonight to actually invent, and this is history. It's definitely history within his organization. But Captain Reed, could you kind of, you know, give us a brief history of how you came up with what is known as the Reed Hood?
Well, I'll give you a short version. Actually, I got tired of getting burned. I love the job, but I got tired of getting burned. That wasn't fun. You'd lay down and your pillow would stick to your head at night. That wasn't fun. I was walking through a flea market one time in the south side of town, and I saw an old welder's cap, and it just, they wear it in the wintertime to stay warm. And I thought, you know, if you put that on our head, that may keep us from burning our ears. And I bought one, and I put it on. And of course, you look goofy because nobody wore anything like that. But I made a fire and did pretty good. I said, wow, except your neck would burn, you know. So I got two of them, and I had my mother, I kind of showed her what I wanted. She sewed them together, and I had the first chin strap was about 2 inches wide. Kind of just covered your chin. That's what you burn, was your chin. So I put that on, and I wore it in the fire, and kind of trial and error. Well, you burn underneath that chin strap, so I made the next one about 4 inches. You burn underneath that, so each fire is kind of trial and error. Each fire, you learned what else you had to do. So we kind of got it right. The flap was big enough, then it was too thin, so I had to make it thicker. And just the process of elimination got to be what it is, where the thing is, you know, the New Yorkers say we wear bunker coats on our heads. You know, what a laugh about it back then. But, it, I mean, why are you wearing bunker pants and bunker coat? Because you need the protection. The same thing you need it on your head. Just a lot of guys aren't up to that yet, but once you wear one and you figure out how much easier it is, you'd have a bunker coat on your head, and you come out and take it off, nobody will see you. It goes like that. But it was the ones I made were out of some cotton material, and they would burn, and I did burn a few off, and so I had to do research into the materials, which we, you know, got Nomex and finally the PVI, which was fantastic stuff. But it was just a process of elimination, trying to get something to work. I learned most of my stuff by doing it. You know, listen, guys say you can do this, and you do it. Yeah, you get your head burned off. You did it. But stuff that worked, stuff that wouldn't work, is trial and error. You know, just thicker here. I doubled it on the ears because it was touching you there, and it would burn through the material and burn your ears, so we're not accomplishing anything. And I'd get, for my crew would wear them, and then we'd make a fire, and the other crews would, you know, see us stand up, pull them, see them, they'd run in and hit the floor and say, how y'all doing that? And, you know, they want them, so it kind of went to the, you know, busy stations around us. Everybody wanted them. Of course, it was not not issued gear, so one of the chiefs said, hey, you can't wear that. I said, okay. So he'd leave, and I'd take it, you know, put it on when he's there and take it off when he was there, so... It was just kind of going around the wrong way, but I knew it worked, and the guys, all the firemen that were wearing them knew it worked, and finally got the attention of one of the fire chiefs, said, well, you got to come talk to me about this, so we took him out to the academy and actually showed him, you know, go in without one and go in with one and tell me what you want to wear. And he said, well, this is stupid enough to have this on. I said, exactly. So just, you know, a lot of the, and I'm not knocking chiefs by any means, but a lot of them don't have the, I don't think they put fires out in their day, so they don't know you can do it, you know, so they don't, if you don't know what you can do with a line, how do you expect anybody else to do it?
Right.
You know, if you don't know you can, that can be put out, And, you know, I probably tank 85% of the fires I make, whichever, you know, just houses. But you can put a lot of water out with tank water. When you got 2.5-3 minutes and have the last fire you made, how long do you have your line open? I know it wasn't that long.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're doing open it up, close it when the fire goes out, and move it till you get some more fire. You put out a lot of fire with 500 gallons, and now they got 750,000-gallon tanks. I mean, you do a lot of work with that.
Yeah. I agree.
It's
amazing to me that we're so worried about
time.
That.
If you can't put out fire with 500 gallons, you weren't going to put it out. And you see departments with 750 gallons, 1,000 gallons, being worried that we don't have hydrant water, we don't have a tanker supply yet, we can't go in there.
Right.
Most, if 1,000 gallons, if you have 1,000 gallons, you're going to do it. You're going to do it really well. And if you can't,
right.
either you're poorly trained or it was way too advanced to begin with and you weren't
right.
going to do it to
right.
begin with.
You should have knocked it down anyway. I mean, that's what the YouTube video, they won't pull a line because they're afraid they're going to run out of water and let the place burn to the ground. You know, it's just amazing. I'm just wow.
So the Reed Hood is pretty exclusive to the Houston Fire Department. Is that correct, sir?
Yes, it's Houston, Texas area. We did some deals in Ohio back in the 80s, and the guys loved them, but their chief said, now we'll have to retrain our whole department if we get them. So it was more since that article in Fire Engineering come out saying that we're not getting any throat cancers at all, it's getting another look. They've come out with it again. But it's just a thing. It's something I can't tell you what it does. I have to show you. And I can't
mm-hmm.
show everybody. You know, it's just one of those deals. But more people are wearing hoods. In fact, all the kids now are wearing hoods. And back in that day, there was nobody hood. You know, no hoods.
Uh-huh.
You know, a single ply penny. I used to call them pantyhose hoods. But now they're all the hoods are pretty good now. You know,
yeah,
they're better
yeah.
than they were. But back then, the sock hoods let steam come straight through them. That's what I was trying to get away from.
Right.
So I built mine with bunker coat material so it wouldn't allow that. And it just happened to keep the throat cancer out. It wasn't designed that way. You know, just one of the benefits
right.
of it. They've come out with a new
Captain
one.
Captain Reed.
Go ahead. Yes, sir.
Last year, I went out to Texas to teach with a friend of the show, Howard Weinwald. And I
yeah.
was with a bunch of Houston firemen, and they showed me your hood, and it was absolutely incredible. I loved it. It was thick. I had to get used
yeah.
to the thickness of it, but
yeah.
did it work? It was a pleasure to use. So I have from New York, and I've used it once in a training burn in Texas, and it was great.
Well, if you it is thick. It is that, but you know, tell you, if next one you were going to go in, if you knew it was going to flash over on you, what would you wear?
Oh, I want the thickest thing on my
you know?
Head if it's about to flash over on me. I definitely know
right.
that from experience,
right.
man. That fire is coming at you. You're scared. You're doing whatever you can to get warm, to get cool.
Right, and that's my deal. I wanted to dress this guy. Find the baddest guy you got. Dress him the best way. So he can make it out, and the rest of everybody else ought to be able to okay, you know, protect the guys that are fighting fire, and the rest of the guys are going to be okay. But you can't wear lightweight stuff and expect to be protected. It didn't work. You know, we had one chief down here that wanted to wear that real lightweight stuff. Well, and we'd be able to, you know, be able to fight fire for hours. I said, yeah, well, that you're going to have to because you can't go in. You know, just,
I love that. And yeah, I think one of the reasons we asked Captain Reed to speak on that is, you know, again, if guys will look at their history and really learn about our job, almost everything that, you know, a 21-year-old kid is using today wasn't invented by some major corporation. It was invented by a guy like Captain Reed. I just read a little blurb not long ago or the other day about Bork's. I know not everybody's familiar with Bork eye shields, but you
right.
know how those came about is a fireman made them at
right.
home,
right?
You know,
yeah.
Salty,
yeah,
on the job. Come on,
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm sitting here some days in my office going, man, what kind of event that, you know, that would be, a moneymaker. But, you know, somebody out there that's on a rig right now is, you know, whether it's a tool or if it's a, you know, a technique, I look at some of the techniques being taught and then I've got the, privilege of learning. I look at some of the things I've learned from guys like Ray McCormick and, you know, him doing the UL studies and, you know, water mapping and angles. And, you know, I'm still blown away at what guys come up with. And I think, again, if guys will take that minute, and, you know, we're keeping traditions alive, I think innovation of firefighters is one of the coolest things about our job of what guys come up with. I'm blown away with what guys figure out, and they don't figure it out from a book or it's the manual.
Right.
Yeah, you know, they literally are out there and they're in their stations or they're at the training grounds or they're at a job and they find and figure out ways to do some of the most incredible things that are imaginable that we all end up using. You know, somewhere,
if
somehow,
all you
we all
know
end up
is
using.
From a textbook, you're not a fireman.
Oh, no. Yeah, it's truly amazing when we talk about that. We're getting near the end here, but I wanted to get everybody's, and I think we talked about this already, but, I don't want to be I don't want us to be on the negatives, and I think we've been, we're always positive. I think we've been positive tonight, but I'd like to hear each person just give me, just kind of tell everybody, what is a positive you see for the future of the American Fire Service? And I'll start with Anthony here.
I think it's the big push that a lot of departments are making to just improve equipment. I know personally it's touched my department, and specifically in something important to me because it's hose and nozzles, and I'm kind of a nerd for that kind of stuff. But when I came in, we were using very, very lightweight, cheap hose, 100 PSI fog nozzles. And a few years ago, we made the change to FDNY spec hose with either smooth bores or low-pressure fog nozzles. And when I came in, we were using 1¾-inch hose with a fog nozzle for standpipe operations. And recently, this year, all of that changed. We bought new hose, all new nozzles, new equipment bags, everything to make sure that that issue was corrected. And a big reason that happened was what I think is great for the fire service is that how many conferences are out there and how many training events are out there. It's so available to you. If you can't afford to go and, you know, get to a big conference, that's a lot of travel, all that kind of stuff, that there's probably something somewhat local for you to go to and learn from somebody. And it never hurts to learn from outside your job. I mean, the guys in your job, they have experience very specific towards your job, but it doesn't hurt to get out and get some outside perspective. It doesn't mean you have to change, but you get some outside perspective and learn some things. It led to some big changes department-wide for us as far as something as simple as our equipment that it hadn't been being, kept up with in a while, that, 100 PSI fog nozzles and lightweight cheap hose wasn't really the thing in the fire service anymore. It had gone away. Staffing was going down. Guys were wanting to have that high flow, low pressure attack package. We were kind of behind the times in getting to it, and we made that move. We ended up correcting some major issues with our standpipe attack packages to make not only us more effective, but make our guys a lot safer. Being in a majority pre-93 city using 1¾-inch with a fog nozzle is really not good for us, and we addressed that. So I think the focus on equipment, because that's something that can always be addressed. That's not an experience issue. That's not, we're not making as many fires. We can make sure our people have the best equipment available, whether it's turnout gear, hose, nozzles, tools, whatever it is. We can handle that regardless of the amount of fires are coming. That's not an issue. Getting your guys properly equipped is not going to change because you're not making as many fires. So the big push of knowledge being pushed out and guys really absorbing it and making change with it, I think that's great. But definitely the training opportunities being so – they're just so available to people now. It's not like, a new guy that's barely making ends meet has to drop a couple $1,000s to get to a major show somewhere. He's probably going to be able to find something somewhat local and still learn from a guy that's very well experienced and be able to take that and then add it to what the guys in his job are teaching him and really start expanding what he knows and what he's seeing and what he's studying and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah,
I love that.
Joe, a positive you see happening in the American Fire Service from your travels and your experience there at FDNY? Did we lose you? Did we lose Joe?
Still showing on the screen.
Still on mute. My positive is how many guys getting into the job are into the job. There's a lot of young guys that are hungry for knowledge, so they are going out onto Facebook and Instagram and YouTube and watching the videos and seeing these training videos online on their own time, and are willing to come into the firehouse and try them for themselves and see what works for them and what doesn't. So that is my positive, is that we are now becoming a very training forward service. The guys coming in, they want to train, they want to drill, they want to learn, they want to practice, they want to get into every building they can. Why? Not because they want to go on a run, because every building is different. So they want to see where the stairwells are, where the standpipes are, what kind of construction this is. Where I work, every building is completely different. There's not one set of rules to govern one set of buildings. So they want to make that EMS run. Why? Not because they want to be an EMT. No, because they know when they get into that building, they get to see something that wouldn't be able to see just from the outside. So the mentality of these guys to just train and learn is so invigorating. And I'm a young boss. I only got 12 years on. I've only been promoted 3 years. I want to train. I want to learn. I want to go. And seeing the guys with 2-3 years on to still have that passion, it just is so fun to go to work and realize that the next run, yeah, maybe that 10th EMS run of the tour, but I may see something really cool in a building that 5 years from now may help me when that building's on fire. And I love that. Into that. And I love seeing that. And that's so positive. And I feel that's so different from even when I got on 12 years ago, there weren't guys that weren't that positive. Now, seems like all the guys are really into it. And I love it.
Yeah, I love that you guys both kind of echoing each other. Captain Reed, I know you're out and about and you get to teach with Howard and those type of things. And what is a positive that you're kind of seeing in your travels and the people you get to speak with and spend time with around the fire service?
Well, I'll tell you what, I love you brothers for speaking your piece, but I love guys that love the fire service, because they're going to be the ones that do the justice to it. I love the young guys that are interested to come to these conferences that really pay attention to what you're saying. And sometimes it's the first time they've ever heard any of this stuff. You know, and I'm old and crusty, and I say stuff off the wall, but they come up to me after, he said, "Are you serious?" I said, "Yeah, man, I'm not going to lie to you. Yeah, I'm just, that's me." But there's so much they don't know. They have a lot of sometimes book knowledge, but no experience. You know, so they're going mainly on what they've read or what they've heard. And you know, back in the day, as I tell the guys, there's one day I made 9 working fires in one day. And they make 9 fires in a year. You know, I had so much fun and just, I just like that, you know, technology is so advanced, and we don't have enough money to get the technology we need. You know, there's stuff out there that just blows my mind, you know. I still love the fire service. I love the firemen. I love the guys that love the job. But there's a bunch of guys, they just show up. You know, they just want a paycheck. They don't care. And that's hard for me. And I said, you know, you're wasting a spot for a guy that really loves his job. But it's just hard to, you know, it's hard for them to hear. There's guys that need to work at slow stations, and I don't want to be one of them, so I'm glad you're here. But, you know, just technology is so far advanced, and train on the basics to be good. And, you know how your equipment works, what it does, what you can do with it, and be ready. You know, be, like I say, dressed for the war to win the battle. Have all your stuff on. It's not time to second guess what can I do? You ought to know what you can do. So, you know, that kind of stuff is just basic stuff. Know your basics, become good at the great stuff.
Yeah,
guys, I appreciate y'all having me on. I appreciate it. It's just we're a fantastic group of brothers here.
I couldn't agree with you more, Cap, man. I think I just kind of have to echo what Joe and Anthony both said. The biggest positive I'm seeing throughout the country is we're starting to see more guys into the job, and I think that's where I know we kind of laugh and joke about, you know, Snapchat and social media and all that stuff. But it's such a cool way to see what other guys are doing throughout the country. I love when guys are sharing videos of them out drilling, and we're so connected now that we can share. And I think that in a lot of ways where social media can be damaging, I think it also can be extremely positive for us all to stay connected. I mean, I look at me, Joe, and Anthony in three different states, but I get to spend time with these guys on a regular basis, just talking and following each other on social media and hearing their stories and ideas. It's incredible. And I look at the rescue that Quinn had the other day for New York, the window rescue. Everybody in the country got to see that. And I guarantee there are guys somewhere in this country going, how prepared are we? Can we do this? We had to do this. And those are positive. The guys are talking about these things and looking at that, go, man, what would we do in that scenario? And that's where I think those kind of social media posts are all positive for our young firefighters. And to be honest, I see a lot of senior guys throughout the country that are more into the job today because of things they're able to attend and read and learn about. And those are positives. I think we're on the right track. I'm a firm believer that the fire service is moving in a great new direction. The guys are into the job. They understand our mission again, and they're fighting for the mission. And, we still got that dead weight. And, I think we'll always have some dead weight around. And we'll just we just all need to understand there's more of us that are into it than there are those guys. So I'm excited to see where we're going to be at, next year, when all this bull crap dies down with the COVID and all that. And we start getting back together. And, I can't wait till the next major conference event just to sit around and have a couple beers and hear guys' stories. I love hearing them. And I learn from them, and it keeps me motivated. So I think those are positive.
And, when a guy see you do something, then they know they can do it. Mm-hmm. And that's a great improvement, because before they don't know. If he can do that, I can do that,
That's I think, I've worked with several departments over the last couple of years, along with some other instructors like Steve Robertson and Brian Brush, where, modified Minuteman loads, they're not trendy anymore. Guys are finding out this shit really works, and they're learning that because they're seeing videos, they're going to classes, and just amazed of how fast something positive can take fire across the entire country and move us forward. Captain Reed, we're going to be closing, but we always end every show, and I always ask each person, and you being the senior man tonight, you get, I want you to, any closing remarks, any last bit of advice before we end the show tonight that you can share with us?
Oh, man, keep loving it. That's all I can tell you. Keep loving it. If you love it,
I think that should be on
T-shirt,
Captain.
Strive to do better, Do what?
Oh, that should be on T-shirt. Don't be a circular.
Well, there you go. That's right. They don't accomplish much.
Putting that on a bumper sticker, I'm going to cut you in on the profits, Captain.
But I appreciate y'all asking me to talk. I wouldn't do too bad, but anytime, I'm available. It's fun.
We definitely appreciate it. Joe, closing remarks for us tonight, bro?
I'm going to echo what Captain Reed said. Be Buffy. Enjoy it. Have fun. I make fun of Buff, but yet I'm the one with a fire podcast. So who's the real buff. Enjoy it.
You're a buff.
Have fun and enjoy it.
You're a buff. You now, and we also know you're a ladder buff. You're a truckie buff.
Secretly.
Secret truckie buff. Anthony.
I'm going to say to what I think tonight's show really echoed was try to get something from the guys that either are about to leave or have already left. There's still so much we can learn from guys like Captain Reed that may not even be on your job anymore. And some jobs just do a lot better job of doing that. Like I know my buddy up in Boston told me they have like a day of the week or one day a month that all the retirees come and hang out at their academy so that they can get together. I think it does a lot for the young guys, and it really teaches them, you know, to honor what was built for them. That there's guys before them that they really had to work, you know, to get to things to where they are today. Like Cam Reed talking about with the gear and getting burnt all the time. Like, don't take that for granted. A lot of guys went through a lot of work and building what you have and building the reputation you get to live off of when you come on the job. So I think we can do a better job of getting that out and getting guys to, you know, bring retired guys back around. And I've loved every time since. I thought it was one of the best things Howard did with the class that we did was starting to bring Captain Reed around. I got to know Captain Reed. And listen, I think what would we say up to like 3 a.m. the first time I met you, just listening to your fire stories, Captain
yeah,
Reed, with Howard.
Sure,
and
yeah.
I mean, but you learn so much from it, and you really get a different perspective of things, and you get to not take it, you know, it's something as simple as you come on and you have this great, you know, high TPP turnout gear, and you're not getting burnt all the time and all this, and you take that for granted. To learn how it came about and what guys went through to get it there, that really goes a long way. So I think, you know, for closing, if you listen to this podcast, you're definitely going to take that out of it anyway, is get with the senior guys, whether they're about to leave the job or they already have, you can still get something from them. And don't, you know, just say, oh, this guy's already gone. So the times have changed. If you listen to the show, you'll see times haven't changed that much. The things Captain Reed's been talking about the whole show is the same things we've been talking about. So get them guys back around and learn from them. There's so much to still learn from them. And once you know, you can do stuff to honor what they've built rather than, you know, go the other way with it. And it's better to honor what they've built for you than go the other way on that one.
There you go.
Man, and absolutely spot on, Anthony. And I couldn't agree with you and Joe and Captain Reed more if I tried. And, you know, I remember seeing my dad come home, and coming out of the hospital after being blown out of the second floor window after making a couple grabs. And he didn't miss a beat. He recovered from the back surgery and went right back on that rig. And, you know, that was it. I mean, it wasn't about, this is too dangerous. There was lives to be saved, and he took those risks and paid a pretty steep price for it. So, and I think about him doing those things, and he laid that groundwork for his department, laid that groundwork for me, Captain Reed. I can't even imagine how many lives that you've influenced with your gear and your being, innovative. And those are the things that we spoke of earlier, knowing the history of the American Fire Service, I think is just crucial to keep us actually moving forward and sometimes taking a look back. My last remark, though, and I'd be, again, one of the things I want us to make sure, not only do I want us all remember 9/11 and 9/12 and keep those brothers and their families in our prayers, as well as the guys that are going to be battling the cancers and all the other horrific events of that day. But I think we also need to all take a second, over the next day or so, or even tonight, and keep those brothers out in California in our hearts too. They're going through a living hell out there in California with those wildland fires. It's over 2 million acres, and I can't even fathom. I've been to brush, I call it a woods fire, and it's like, 400 yards of woods. You're like, oh my God, they're out there battling 2 million acres of fire.
That's right.
Well, a lot different than, I have the utmost respect for what those guys do, because I can't even imagine how hard those guys are working trying to save people's homes and lives. And they've already saved countless lives in this last episode of wildland fires out there. So you know, let's keep those brothers in our thoughts and prayers, and hope that they all, you know, get through all this safe and get to go home to their families as well. Guys, as always, it's never a dull moment talking to you three. Captain Reed, you definitely raised the bar for all of us and raised the bar for our next guest, whoever that will be. And we couldn't appreciate you more, brother, and thank you.
Well, I thank you a lot for having me.
Thank you
all
so
right,
much,
well, Anthony. Anthony, we will let you, you know, do whatever you do on that fancy computer gizmo you got there. And we'll be talking to everybody very soon. Thank you for listening.
Yes, sir. Thank you.